Some of you are going to find this a bit incredulous, but here's something that federal, state, and local governments all tell us to do that we should actually listen to. Eat more fruits and vegetables. You've heard about the health benefits of increasing plant-based nutrients into your diet, but how can you easily consume all the fruits and veggies needed? Well, it's easy. By adding grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity into your meals. Grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity is a power blend that has 31 fruits and vegetables in every scoop. Organic vegetables, super greens, super fruits, and super sprouts. It is fortified with essential vitamins plus an immunity boost. And right now, you can get a free 2-week supply of grown American superfood and essential vitamins plus immunity by just paying $8.95 for the shipping and handling. And not only that, you'll also get a free frother to quickly whip up your healthy and nutritious Grown American drink. Go to grownamericansuperfood.com/John and order today.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
I'm John Fugelsang. This is Sirius XM Progress Channel 127. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Dino Vidala and his excellent squad for a wonderful live lead-in. God bless Dickie Betts, legendary guitarist for the Allman Brothers, who wrote and sang their number one hit, Ramblin' Man. He has died at his home in Florida at the age of 80 of cancer and complications of COPD. A true virtuoso. And even if you don't like the Allman Brothers, you have grooved to his guitar before. Hey, I'm Fugelsang. It's so great to have you with us. For the next 3 hours, we're going to be coming at you with a lot of empathy and facts and reality and deeply inappropriate humor and obscure music and pop culture trivia. And as always, our most important guest is you. But tonight, you're in first, but it's pretty tight competition. The very funny Jesse Joyce is going to join us. He is a Emmy-nominated writer, and he's a Writers Guild Award winner. He writes for Kimmel. He's been with Kimmel forever, and he writes for Kimmel for the Oscars, and he wrote for Donald Trump's roast. He's written for everything. He's really funny. He's written a deeply offensive book about our greatest president. It's called Killing the Guys Who Killed the Guy Who Killed Lincoln, a nutty story about Edwin Booth and Boston Corbett. It's a riot. It's very vulgar. And I'm very excited to have Jesse Joyce on our show for the first time. Also, we're going to have our Indigenous Voices segment now in number 2 with Simon Moya Smith and Julie Franchella. And hey, that reminds me, Lindy Lee is not just joining us on the show. She's going to join us on stage this coming weekend. Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberal Save the World Tour is coming to Philly. I'm very excited to be in business with Live Nation, and Stephanie, Hal Sparks, Frangela, and I will be going on stage in Philly Saturday, the 27th of April. Go to sexyliberal.com for tickets. There are still some meet and greet tickets, I think. Also joining us on stage will be Miss Lindy Lee, JoJo from Jers, who's another friend of this show that you all probably know from social media, and the one and only Mr. Glenn Kirshner will be joining us on stage as well. That should be something with enough legal intelligence and rank vulgarity for a broad spectrum of leftists. You might ask yourself, self, how does this guy with the weird last name do this show? Well, I'm so glad you rhetorically asked yourself, self. Chris Hauselt is our executive producer. He makes this job easy from his perch high atop the SiriusXM studios somewhere in South Carolina. They won't actually give me the address. Thea Harper produces our show out of Brooklyn, and I come to you tonight from the panoramic splendor of Santa Monica, California. It's been a pretty crazy day that we're going to talk about Donald Trump's trial tonight. We're going to talk about prominent members of the Kennedy political dynasty gathering to endorse Joe Biden to ignore Bobby Kennedy Jr. again. We're going to talk about a UN Security Council resolution extending full membership to a Palestinian state that was brought to vote and vetoed by the United States. This is, of course, 1 month after our president gave that barn burner of a speech, State of the Union, where he talked about the need for a two-state solution. Yep. American diplomats spent days behind the scenes trying to persuade the UN to scrub the public vote. And the World Health Organization says they are watching very closely and with great concern as avian flu spreads through American dairy cattle. World Health Organization says that the H5N1 strain has an extraordinarily high fatality rate among humans. Just something else to keep you awake at night. Let's do a show. Let's talk about the most do-nothing Congress in history, because I got to say, I'm constantly impressed at how much the most do-nothing Congress in history can do to make it seem like they're doing something, when in reality, they do a whole lot to make sure nothing gets done. Now, what I just said shouldn't make sense, but as the House prepares to vote on a new military aid package for Ukraine, a new mass slaughter package for Netanyahu, a "we really hope you don't need this package" for Taiwan, and some kind of wacky fondue of a stew package that involves banning TikTok, because that'll help Biden so well with young voters, are we actually witnessing Speaker of the House Mike Johnson being willing to set his entire career on fire just to do the right thing? Is that what's happening here? I mean, let me put it this way. What makes you more nervous? That the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has no control over certain members of his right-wing caucus because they're all just doing what Putin wants? Or is it more scary to think that what if Mike Johnson's in cahoots with them and this is all theater to further stall Ukraine aid and make sure that nothing gets passed before they all go away for a week because they all just do what Putin wants? Either way, either Ukraine's going to get the aid or Johnson's going to get the boot, or most likely both. I mean, the weekend is when the votes are going to come. The votes are going to put his job on the line. The House Speaker has now confused everybody by refusing to box out Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Nazi clot caucus's effort to oust him over this foreign aid. Like, Mike Johnson, I don't know, is this a Star Wars moment, Chris? Is this like Skywalker turning off his targeting computer in the Death Star trench? Like, he's really using the Force here. He's opting, Mike Johnson, to not try to change the rules on how to remove a speaker. Remember when Kevin McCarthy was groveling and Matt Gaetz said, well, only one member can now file a motion to vacate, you know, so any clown can pull the trigger on a resolution to fire you?
It is Star Wars, but it's not the Luke Skywalker in the Death Star trench run.
What is it?
It's that moment where Obi-Wan turns his lightsaber off and kind of bows his head and he says, if you strike me down, I'll become stronger than you can ever imagine.
Mm-hmm. It's
kind of like a defeatist challenge, kind of acceptance of fate.
Okay, so you're saying that like Alec Guinness, he's willing to sacrifice himself to help the others. That is what it looks like on the surface. But this is Mike Johnson we're looking at, and I'm like, why would he begin doing that now? But he has chosen to not try and change the rules on how to remove people. We've talked about this all week. We have talked about this so much in spite of the fact that it's talking about a lot of nothing. But Marge and Thomas Massey are threatening to have another motion to vacate and fire this guy because he's going to try to get aid to Ukraine to slow down Putin's massacre without necessarily having border language attached, because you really can't, because you groveling supplicants killed the border bill at the behest of Donald Trump. If the aliens land tomorrow, I don't want to be the guy to have to explain this to them. So a lot of House Republicans were surprised. He said he lacks the votes to change how many members it takes to bring up a motion to vacate. So yesterday he said he was willing to risk his job for Ukraine aid. And today he said those Kevin McCarthy, Matt Gaetz changes from a year ago on how to fire a speaker were bad for the Republicans, bad for the speakership, which I agree. But he's not going to try and change it because he doesn't have enough votes. He can't change the rules to save his job because he doesn't have enough support from his own caucus to change the rules to save his job. At the Capitol, CNN's Manu Raju gathered Matt Gaetz and Eli Crane and Thomas Massey all at once. You can smell the sulfur through your radio. Here is a chorus of disapproval for Mike Johnson's foreign military aid deals.
There's no other way to describe it. It's surrender. It's disappointing. I won't support it.
It's disappointing. It's completely detached from what our base wants, what our voters want.
The strategy is not to try. I think the strategy is to fall on his sword.
all of them are furious that it's going to be harder for Putin to commit mass murder on a U.S. ally. That's what we're talking about here. And so now he's going to push forward on the foreign aid package, and he knows he's going to probably face an attempt to fire him in the next couple of days. So he has to work with the Democrats now and not double-cross the Democrats like his predecessor McCarthy did, because roughly, I don't know, a few days from now, maybe by Saturday, he's going to need those Democrats to save his job. Here's Mike Johnson defending his actions as what he thinks is rightly expected of an American political leader. Do you buy it? Give a listen.
I'm a child of the 80s. I regard myself as a Reagan Republican. I understand the concept of maintaining peace through strength. That's one of our guiding principles. It's a really important philosophy, and it's a big part of our party and our worldview. And I think here is an opportunity to make that stand at a really critical time in world history. I mean, there are global implications to what we do. So, look, everybody can grumble about details of the legislation. What are mine, my friends, and everybody you just showed are all good friends. Listen, we're not going to get 100% of what we want right now because we have the smallest majority in history, and we only have the majority in one chamber. The Republicans run the House. We have the small majority in the House. The Democrats are in charge of the Senate and the White House. So we're, by definition, we won't get everything we want, but we got a great product here at the end, much better than the alternative that came in the Senate supplemental. And now everybody gets to vote their conscience, up or down. That's what we're for, regular process, regular order, and accountability to the people. And I think you'll see that here this week.
I agree with so much of that. Why is it so hard to trust this man? I mean, if he's serious about finally funding the aid that Ukraine desperately needs, then good for him. I'll take my scarf off to the man. But now he's going to try and push this through without any kind of protection for his job. And Democrats will bail him out. Nancy Pelosi said that Johnson's been courageous in standing up to the anti-government wing of his party. But Congressman Dan Kildee, Democrat from Michigan, said McCarthy was both incompetent and dishonest. Johnson is just incompetent. Now, it's kind of scary because when you think about what is at stake here and that we are trying to help our allies in Kyiv repel Russia's bloodthirsty invasion of conquest and slaughter and rape and stealing children. And we have pretty much abandoned these allies. They have not had artillery for a long time because of a few Republicans in our Congress. Now, you might be wondering, if this aid package does get passed over the weekend, how fast will that aid be in the missile launchers of the Ukrainian military? Well, Major General Pat Ryder gave reporters an answer on that today.
If the bill is passed by the House and Senate and signed into law, just how quickly can the Department of Defense get weapons moving to Ukraine? And have you done anything to speed that along, such as pre-position some things in Europe?
Sure. Well, obviously, as I'm sure you can appreciate, I can't get into any specifics on timelines as it relates to pending legislative proposals. We obviously do look forward to an upcoming supplemental vote. But in the meantime, were the supplemental to get passed, we are poised to respond quickly with a security assistance package via our presidential drawdown authority. As you know, we have a very robust logistics network that enables us to move materiel very quickly. As we've done in the past, we can move within days. Again, for operation security reasons, I'm not going to be able to get into the specifics of what that security assistance package could look like, other than to say it would, of course, include likely important things like air defense and artillery capabilities. But again, we'll have much more to follow, and we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Here's what that really boils down to. Does your Republican congressman take credit for infrastructure and other benefits like expanded broadband that they actually voted against? Does your Republican congressman pander to veterans, even though he voted many times against the PACT Act, which helps give health care for veterans affected by the burn pits? Well, here's the deal. The overwhelming majority of this money we're talking about sending over to Ukraine, you know, when you hear these little Republicans, these little weasels talking about sending money to Ukraine when the border needs money, send, well, oh, Joe Biden's got endless money for Ukraine. The overwhelming majority of all those dollars will be spent right here in the United States. It's going to ramp up manufacturing at many, many key industrial sites. It's going to create a lot of jobs. It's going to improve a lot of jobs for many By I mean thousands of skilled industrial American workers. And a lot of members of Congress voted in favor of aid that's going to their district, but a whole lot of them, as we have discussed, have been very, very against Ukraine aid, and yet this money is still going to help them with the folks back home. The Washington Post had a report today that shows the military aid we're talking about not only protects Ukrainian civilians and advances our security and the security of our NATO partner nations, it's incredibly good for workers and manufacturing here at home. Because here's the deal. I've always said this. I said this during Iraq. I said this during Afghanistan. It's not popular, but war is a socialist jobs program. Let me say it again. War is a socialist jobs program. I'm not pro-war. I want this war to end. This war ends when Vladimir Putin gets what we call the fuck out of somebody else's country. But 90% of the $68 billion in military and assistance Congress has already approved, 90% of that $68 billion did not go to Ukraine. It was spent in the United States. This is according to an analysis by Mark Hansian of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. A lot of Ukraine aid is going to the congressional districts where congressmen opposed the Ukraine aid. I mean, it's kind of amazing. Matt Gaetz's district, Niceville, Florida. Well, Ukraine aid is funding the high mobility artillery rocket and the Hellfire and Javelin engineering in his district. It's funding the HIMARS launchers and Vampire counter-unmanned aircraft systems munitions in Congressman Bill Posey's Melbourne, Florida district. How about Anna Paulina Luna? She really hates Joe Biden. She really hates doing anything to help Ukraine, doesn't she? She's in Clearwater, Florida. She's going to get funding for HIMARS guidance sets and ANTPQ-53 radar systems. I mean, we can run down congressman after congressman on the Republican side. What about Jim Jordan? Lima, Ohio, their congressional district, they make Abrams tanks and Stryker combat vehicles for the Ukraine. And that's all thanks to the military aid that Jim Jordan has opposed. You understand? This is not just they vote against infrastructure and then take credit for the jobs and the programs back home. They are voting against helping an ally, even though that money is helping create jobs and stimulate the economies in their district. Lance Gooden in Mesquite, Texas. Ukraine is funding a brand new factory that's going to produce about 20,000 155-millimeter artillery shells every month. He voted against it. Scott Perry, his district's going to make Bradley infantry fighting vehicles. He voted against it. 80% of this new military aid package for Ukraine will go to Americans. $23.2 billion to replenish U.S. stockpiles of weapons and equipment that we have already provided to Ukraine. So here's the clip of the day. At the House Rules Committee, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut brings some receipts, recounts the facts, and reads her Republican counterparts for filth.
I sat in the White House, not in a classified meeting, where Republican colleagues said that we won't have Ukraine without bipartisan border security. And then you know what? We accomplished bipartisan border security. It wasn't, and it was, oh, you can shake your head all you want, but Democrats and Republicans voted for border security. And you know what? It was Donald Trump who said, don't give Biden a win. You think about that. Put that aside. This moment is now. The United States Senate, you can have all the views you want about the United States Senate, but hold them for this debate. It is now. It is about the United States House of Representatives. We have the opportunity to do what we do here, and that is to govern. And what are we doing in governing? Is that to be a world leader. And for months and months, we have been diddling around where people are dying in Ukraine. Don't talk about what weapons we want to give them. We're not giving them what they need now, and it has been months in the coming. And we ought to today, immediately, we should have picked up that Senate bill, brought it to the floor, and voted on it immediately, and we would be out of here today in doing it. Let us not rewrite what is happening. The moment is ours.
Rosa DeLauro, I'll have what she's having. So this is the deal. War is evil. War is horrible.
This war is caused by Vladimir Putin. This war ends when he gets the hell out of somebody else's country. If somebody invades your house and kills your pets and kills your kids and rapes your wife and burns down your garage, you don't say to them, hey, how many rooms in my house do you want so you'll start being nice to me? Providing military assistance to Ukraine, well, it sucks that we have to do it. It is the right thing to do. If you think we should have tried to stop Hitler at Czechoslovakia, it is the right thing to do. These American-made weapons are protecting the civilians, women and children, from being blown up by Russians in Ukraine. It's stopping Russia from seizing more cities and slaughtering more innocent people. It is decimating the Russian military. We have a responsibility morally and for our own national security to make sure that Russia can't gobble up these countries. I protested when Bush tried to do this in Iraq. I protest when Putin tries to do it now. So that's why I say, look at how much this funding is going to benefit Americans. It's going to benefit Republican districts. It's going to help the people they represent. It's going to help Ukraine and democracy and their own districts. But so many of these House Republicans are still furious about it. Maybe it's time we start wondering why. We want to know what you guys think. We're at 866-997-4748. 866-997-GRIT. It's so nice not talking about you-know-who comb over Caligula's trial. But we will get to that tonight. And when we come back, we'll be joined by the very brilliant and funny Jesse Joyce, who has the most important historical book of the year, Killing the Guys Who Killed the Guy Who Killed Lincoln, a nutty story about Edwin Booth and Boston Corbett. This is SiriusXM. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So you know what Jesus and Lincoln have in common? Both of them had their whole operations taken over by the guys who killed him. Roman Empire off Jesus and took over his movement. And of course, a Southern Confederate racist douchebag killed Lincoln, and Southern racist Confederate douchebags took over Lincoln's party. And to this day, they're defending the Southern racist Confederate douchebag flag and statues of dead Southern racist Confederate douchebags. So you guys know John Wilkes Booth, and you know the story of how he killed President Lincoln. But did you know the story of the man who killed John Wilkes Booth? And did you know the story of John Wilkes' older, more talented, more successful brother, Edwin? You think you've got siblings you're embarrassed of? Well, this is all packaged into the essential new historical book, Killing the Guys Who Killed the Guy Who Killed Lincoln, a nutty story about Edwin Booth and Boston Corbett. It is written by one of the funniest guys in the game, Jesse Joyce. He's an Emmy-nominated and Writers Guild Award-winning comedy writer and comic. He's written for Kimmel on everything and the Oscars, and he's written for the Comedy Central roast and the Trump roast and the Emmy Awards and the Tony Awards, but nothing will prepare you for this book. It is the smart, funny, and deeply vulgar historical comedy a weary nation didn't know we needed. Jesse Joyce, welcome to SiriusXM.
Hey, how are you? Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Deeply vulgar is important. And be careful about like selling the like how important this is historically, because this is a comedy book. So I don't want to run afoul of actual professional historians. I'm just a giant history dork. So,
oh, listen,
anyway.
No. Just so you know, I'm a giant comedy dork. And so I think anyone who listens to the interview will get a general sense of the tone of your book.
Yeah,
but I want to push back on you about your own material, because I think any book that calls John Wilkes Booth a fuckface, a dumb guy, a selfish shithead, a showboating idiot, and a flagrant douchebag with a pedophile's mustache is a work of serious scholarship and must be discussed. So I thank you. Well, I think you're doing the Lord's work with this.
The editor and I had to, we came up with, just decided to start calling him Fuckface because there were so many Johns at the time. Like, there's 90 people in this book named John. And so it just gets, you know, tedious to just keep John Wilkes Booth the whole time. So it's just like, all right, from now on, he's Fuckface. So,
well, I get it. And you can't call him Booth because you got his brother there. So Fuckface is a shorthand.
Exactly. Right.
People of all backgrounds can easily follow along. Can I start with the most obvious question? I'm sure you've been asked many times. Why this subject, and what was the process that led you to deciding you wanted to write a book like this about these guys?
So just basically, like, I'm just a guy who knows like three things about a lot of things, you know, like, and that's, I can't really expound more deeply than that usually, but I have a lot of fun little historical nuggets just clanking around my brain. And I always knew, and this is a spoiler, I'm tipping a thing, that the guy who killed John Wilkes Booth was this fascinating goofball who he castrated himself before this. Like, so he then joined the Civil War after he cut his own balls off with a pair of scissors. And then later in life, he ended up living in a giant hole that he dug in a field in Kansas. And somewhere in the middle, he became an American hero. And I just thought, like, what an interesting guy that is. And then separately, I always knew this one little nugget that people don't seem to know, that John Wilkes Booth had a way more famous brother and a way more famous dad who were both like beloved actors. And that one time Edwin saved Robert Lincoln's life at a train station, like a year before John killed Abraham. Edwin saved Lincoln's son. And so they invited him to the White House, and they like went to see him perform Hamlet. And then they like, he became like a beloved guy in their family. And so, which makes it all the more shocking that then, like, a year later, this guy's shitty little brother comes and kills the president. So I just knew those things.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, this makes a fun book, you know? So
I have to say, I mean, I don't even know where to begin, but you know, let me begin with Booth himself, with John Wilkes, with Fuckface. I think a lot of people believe that he was this great actor at the time, and this myth has grown up around him that he was sort of, you know, the Daniel Day-Lewis of his era. He really wasn't. He was sort of like the Zeppo, or maybe even the Gummo of the Booth acting family, wasn't he?
Yeah. It's hard to put like an exact, like, I've kind of gone with the dumber Baldwins before.
Yeah, I guess you have.
Or, you know, the lamer Hemsworths. Like, there's a bunch of different. So that's what he was like. I think, you know, what's a good one is the in a way, is the Douglas family, right? Because Kirk was really famous, and then Michael was really famous, and then there was Eric, who wasn't, and kind of was an angry, whatever. Anyway, so.
But Eric, we root for in our hearts.
Right. I mean, Eric wasn't a bad.
Wilkes was just a dick.
I don't need to paint. It's like if one of those guys killed the president, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Which would be so crazy to everyone. And so, like, the next day, when after the Lincoln assassination, the way people talked about it was, did you hear that Edwin Booth's brother killed the president? Like, people didn't know. And it's Southern revisionist history. Like, back when they started putting up Confederate statues and all that horse shit, like, you know, in the teens and 20s, that's when all of a sudden the, like, you know, the daughters of the Confederacy, these like chubby mint julep swilling goofballs, started saying that, like, oh, John was this celebrity actor. Like, he absolutely was not. He was the lamest one in the whole family. And the whole family said it. Like, there's actual Asia, his sister, wrote a book. Yeah. But yeah, like, exactly. And Asia wrote a book, and she says that, like, I don't know. He doesn't really have it. And Edwin wrote a letter to his brother June and was like, yeah, I don't think John's gonna do much. Like, they all kind of were like, oh, this, you know, that he was sort of the albatross around the family's neck in the acting world, because they were all like a family of actors.
Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, one of my favorite bits of trivia that I'm obsessed with is the fact that when this happened and the murder was done, people burned their John Wilkes Booth autographs. And the unexpected irony of that is that to this day, a John Wilkes Booth autograph is so rare, it's worth like 10 times what a Lincoln autograph is in that community.
Oh, yeah. Oh, look, and check it out. Yeah, I have right here. This is Edwin's. I have Edwin's autograph. his older brother. That's a real one, because Edwin was super famous and everybody loved Edwin. So yeah, that's easy to get. But you're right, it's impossible to get a John Wilkes Booth autograph.
Now, of course, your book is about these two guys. Only one of them killed the guy who killed Lincoln. What was it that made you decide you wanted to make it about these two very, very different men who are both inextricably linked to the first presidential assassin?
Well, because I like the idea of the duality of just kind of like bouncing back and forth between them, as far as, you know, it would make a fun, interesting read that way. But mm-hmm. they had a lot in common, right? They both at one point in time were the most famous guy in America, and one fell out of favor because of the other one, you know, in a way. So, you know, Edwin was, you know, the biggest celebrity in the country, touring around doing theaters. And then after John kills the president, he has to quit acting and he goes into hiding. And then 12 days later, Boston Corbett, the eunuch, he kills John Wilkes Booth. And then he becomes the most famous man in America. And he starts touring around the country doing theater tours, right? Like reenacting how he killed John Wilkes Booth. It's like this fascinating, they're both alcoholics. They both their alcoholism was spurned because somebody they love very much died in a unfortunate way. Like there's just a lot, they just had a lot of, and they both kind of, their just fates were linked to John Wilkes Booth, you know, and that
it's amazing.
One of them became famous because of them and one of them is not remembered anymore because of them. I thought there's kind of an interesting connection between them.
I got to be honest, my dad was a history teacher. I've always been really into Lincoln, and I never knew anything about Corbett and the way his life was before he killed Booth. Now, he was literally a Mad Hatter. I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
And of course, castrating himself, cutting off his own testicles. I imagine you kill the president's assassin, and that's only the second most interesting thing you've ever done in your life.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And like everybody in the unit, in the cavalry unit, knew that too. They were like, oh, there he is, Ballless Corbett. You know what I mean? Like he was just such a weird guy. And that's because that was a real thing. Like, I think a lot of people hear the term Mad Hatter and they don't know for sure that was because that was like a genuine condition. Because
was it the mercury?
They didn't. Yes, that's exactly what it was. It's because they start. Well, I think it's a fun little story of how this. So they used to steam hats in the hatter's urine. That's how the process was done.
That's
so
true.
If you see any guy with a picture like from the 1830s and earlier, if they're wearing a hat that was soaked in a guy's piss. Right. So that's how you made hats. And then they started to notice this weird thing that people who had syphilis made better hats. And people like went to the guys who had syphilis to make their, and that's because they treated syphilis with liquid mercury. And they started to realize like, oh, it's probably not the piss. It's probably the mercury.
Like mercury.
And so they started steaming hats in mercury, which meant that people who made hats sat in a room with no windows, breathing in mercury vapor all day long.
It's so hard to get pure piss in your hats. It's so hard to get the pure kind.
Exactly right. Yeah. So he would just breathe this liquid metal in all day long, and just it made him super crazy. And he started hearing voices, and God started talking to him. And he got propositioned by a couple prostitutes, and he used to read the Bible a lot, and he got really horny about it, and he got upset with himself for being horny about it. And so he went back to his apartment and he cut off his balls with a pair of scissors. And then he went to, and then he just like hung out for the day and like went to church and like didn't, he made himself dinner. Like he didn't go to And then like the people in church were like, hey, you should maybe get that checked. Like, and then he spent a month in the hospital. He almost died. And then right after that, the Civil War started and he joined up and became like a super soldier. He's a fascinating character.
I mean, I guess in many ways, it seems like the insanity propelled him to be even more interesting. I mean, his feats on the battlefield. Yeah. And then the fact that even after that, after he kills the assassin, he's still racked with paranoia and at one point believed that Booth was still alive.
Yeah. Oh, so that's a really interesting, like, you know, I think part of what being, if your dad's a history teacher too, he probably imbued this in you as well, that being a history dork is super comforting, right? Because you don't get too wound up about, like, in the day-to-day, it's like, sure, yeah, like, this is a very scary time. But if you look at where would you rather live? When would that be? Like, every time was the worst time to be alive. You know what I mean? It's terrifying. Like, there was so many horrible, like, it's just a very scary. And yeah, exactly. And so, wait, I lost my thread. Where was I going with this? What did you ask me?
I was asking about Corbett and about how he believed that Booth was still alive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, QAnon. That's where I was going with this.
Right on.
There was like a 19th century QAnon, right? There were just morons that started believing, they started convincing themselves that John Wilkes Booth wasn't dead. And because Edwin Stanton, who is the, are you familiar? There's a show right now on Apple TV called Manhunt, right?
Yes, we haven't even gotten to that yet. Yes.
So anyway, so this guy, Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, he intentionally was like, we're not going to have a body. So because we didn't want assholes someday going to John Wilkes Booth's grave with tiki torches. You know what I mean? So like they didn't. So because people didn't get to see his body, they just started, you know, just morons started going like, well, he's probably not dead. And so then Corbett started believing it. And even though he had spent like 12 years testifying at Congress and making a living on the road, talking about specifically how he killed John Wilkes Booth, he then started going, I don't know, did I kill, like, I, and he started getting afraid that John Wilkes Booth was coming to get him because he was mad because Boston killed him, right? And he gets a telegram from some troll from the 19th century who basically is like, I'm coming to get you, like, oh, signed beautiful. John Wilkes Booth. And he freaks out and he sells his house and he packs up a bunch of guns and he moves to Kansas and digs a giant hole in the ground and then just lives there with the guns pointed at the hole opening for years, like that. Like for many years, he lives that way. And eventually, some veterans organization is like, hey, that guy used to be really famous. He was like Lincoln's avenging angel, right? Like people like loved Boston Corbett at a point in time. But now right. he's this crazy old man who lives in a hole. And so they give him a job as the door guy at the Kansas State House, which is essentially just like a Walmart greeter. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't have to do, he's just like a, all he has to do is like be like a famous guy who just stands there right. at the door and shakes yeah. hands. And people are like, oh my God, you're the guy.
He's like a casino greeter. Like, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
exactly. And he has to tell him where the outhouse is. That's like it. That's his whole job. And then at some point though, he just one day he starts, you know, his paranoia is setting in and he starts hearing, you know, people snickering in the lobby of the Kansas State House. And he's like, they know that I'm a fool because they know John Wilkes Booth is coming to get me. And he pulls out his guns and holds the entire Kansas State House hostage for hours. Like all the legislators, the Speaker of the House is somehow able to escape out a window. But like he holds hundreds of people hostage for hours until the police have to show up and they distract him by opening and closing a door really fast. And he gets mesmerized by the door and then they tackle him and then they put him in an asylum. And he spends like a year and a half in there and he stabs a guy. And then eventually one day he just busts out of there and then takes off for Mexico. And that's it. That's what we know about him. He's a fascinating dude. Just an unbelievable, hilarious loon from the 1900s.
I mean, if you were around today, he'd make a great QAnon candidate, except for the fact that he hates the Confederacy. Man. But I have to ask you, Mr. Joyce, and I bet money you've thought about this. Who do you see playing Corbett in the movie? Who could play this character?
So maybe a Nicolas Cage type, I think, you know, I think would be good. That's kind of maybe a Tom Hardy, possibly, you know, just somebody who's like real kind of, you know, has the ability to have like super crazy eyes, you know, and maybe be mumbly and weird. So that's who I thought.
I have to ask you about Edwin Booth. John Wilkes' much more talented brother. Now in New York City, we have a statue of him down at Gramercy. And then the Booths donated the statue of William Shakespeare in Central Park that in the south side of the park. That's iconic. But this really ruined his career, didn't it? Your brother killing the president doesn't help sell tickets, it turns out.
Well, you know, yes, it did for a while. And I think that was almost more, like people were kind of suspicious of him and whatever. And he did get called in for questioning and stuff. The rest of the family was like totally ruined. It just so happened that that Edwin was so famous that he was kind of able to skirt a lot of the other siblings spent time in jail over this, even though they had nothing to do with it. But Edwin, just because he was like friends with a bunch of governors and the president loved him and, you know, like, you know, he was buddies with the Secretary of State and, that because he was such a beloved famous guy that he got off easier than the others. But still, for him, he thought he was like the Booth. Nobody's going to remember me after I'm dead now. And like, you know, he was a pretty egotistical guy and that was really important to him. And but interestingly, he had a whole second act like playing bad guys, which was fascinating because he got more popular then because, you know, there wasn't there wasn't much media there, but everybody knew what John's face looked like because those wanted posters went all over the world. And so they looked a lot alike and people would get to go and see a guy with John Wilkes Booth's face, like as a scheming Iago or playing Hamlet, like, you know, trying to figure out how to kill the king. And it was like, holy shit, it's unbelievable. Like that guy, like, so he really was a perfect bad guy then after that.
I do have to ask you, I think this is not your first brush with the presidency, because you previously have your impressive resume, your time being a joke writer for the Comedy Central roast of Donald Trump. And I'd be most remiss if I didn't ask if your experience working with the host of Celebrity Apprentice prepared you for the presidency. I emceed an event for him once years ago, and the man that I worked with was exactly the man who became president. And I'm curious what your experience was.
Just an absolute douche. Just the worst guy. The worst guy I've ever had to deal with in the comedy world. Just such a blowhard who thought he was funny. And he's violently not funny. Like, Donald Trump has the comedic timing of an electrical fire in an orphanage. Like, he's so not funny. And he thinks he's hilarious. And that is a terrible combination when you're trying to write comedy for that guy. Because he keeps... Like, there's actually, you can find it online. There's a copy of the script that he got his hands on, and he just went in and like blacked out, just sharpied cartoonishly like he does. Like, he sharpied out a bunch of punchlines and just added his own dumb shit. And there was even a joke. There was some joke. We needed him to do a joke about his hair, and he was refusing to do it. And it was just like innocuous, because this is before we knew the rape and whatever else. Like, you know what I mean? So like, one of the things you could hit him on is like, he's a scumbag and he's probably a racist and he has shitty hair. Like, there wasn't as much, you know? So there was a joke, like, we need, like, you know, and he refused to do a joke about his own hair. And we were like, come on, man, like, you have to, everybody's going to be hitting you on your hair all night. You have to like have the best joke about it. You have to rebut it or whatever. And he just was like so pissy about it. And finally he agreed to do some joke. And I think the gist of it was some of the effect of like, what's the difference between my head and a wet raccoon? A wet raccoon doesn't have $3 billion or something like that. Right. It was like a stupid, but he was so mad about it that he like intentionally undersold it on the day. Like, he just, he shit the bed with that joke. He didn't deliver it like the way it was. Not that he's got a good, but you could tell he like undersold it, where he oversells everything.
What I think you're saying is that he doesn't listen to the counsel of the more experienced, intelligent people in the room who are trying to help him. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah. But then what's worse is when it bombs, he then goes, the goddamn writers made me do that joke, and I told him I didn't want to do it. It was like, oh yeah, well, how about the other 20 jokes you did that crushed, you dumb shit? You know what I mean? Like, it was infuriating, because it was like, yeah, we wrote all of your things. We wrote the rest of them, the ones that worked, you know? I mean, I've always said that I have a joke in my stand-up about how, because I'm such a history dork and I'm a big fan of the presidency. Like, I've read a lot of books about the president, you know? And so it's especially galling for me that he's the only one that I got to meet and had and worked with, and he made my job hard and he fucked up my day. And like, so it's like being a lifelong Buffalo Bills fan, and then you finally meet the most famous one, and it's OJ. You know, like, that's gotta be a bummer for them, you know? So, well, God rest his soul, by the way.
I'm the same way. I'm so ashamed of myself and my connection. I used to see Nixon at the Mets games all the time when I was a kid. And Nixon is a much more hipper connection for me to have been in the same stadium as that guy than Trump. Nixon redeems me. Can I ask a semi-serious question? Because I enjoyed Trump's post about Kimmel yesterday. And, you know, look, I agree with Trump that Kimmel was great in Godfather 2. You can't take that away from him. But with all the concerns about a potential second Trump term, which I don't think is going to happen, but what would a second Trump term do for comedy?
Yeah, I really like when people are like, oh, I bet that's going to be great for comedy or whatever, you know, like, trust me, I'd rather not have the world burned down, you know? Like, exactly. So, you know, I mean, look, we've made funny things happen in leaner times. Like, don't you worry about giving us more comedy ammunition. We're good. Like, so yeah, it's been exhausting. I mean, like, it is gratifying to take him down and then literally see that he gets really mad about it. Like that, that we know it bugs him, right? Like, it's 5 weeks later and he gets up yesterday and is still stewing about that line at the Oscars. That's satisfying on a level, but I mean, it's been 9 years of this, so it's getting exhausting.
I would have been fine with Bill Clinton as the first lady. I could have lived off that for jokes for four years. I would have been grateful. It would have been just enough for me. But yeah,
sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I mean, we know. I mean, there's the range of options to make fun of Biden for is slimmer, but we'd still do it. And it's still fun. You know,
Gavin who loves America
fun
more?
To make fun of, you know, like, so what's that?
Well, who loves America more than a comedian willing to part with Trump material? I think that's the height of patriotism.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just the fact that he got rid of the correspondence dinner just bugs the shit out of me, you know, because, like, you know, famously, like, he got so butthurt because they made fun of him at that one on Obama's or whatever. But so, you know, like that, I used to like hold that up. It's such a silly nonsense that I bet not many people think about how that's amazing that we have a system where just some random fucking some comic, you know, on TV can just go and make fun of the leader of the country to their face. Got this like roast thing once a year, and it's
why we're great.
It's beautiful. Like there's just there's so many countries where you can't do that shit, and the Correspondents' Dinner is like not important as it is to me. Was like, wow, it's a comedy event where you're making fun of the president to his face. Like that is a beautiful thing about this country, and the fact that he won't do those, like just even on that level, it bugs me. Like so, yeah. I don't know.
Jesse Joyce.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're all hoping that doesn't happen.
I'm very much with you. I'm a longtime fan, first time suck up. It's a pleasure to have you here. This platform is always open to you. The book is Killing the Guys
Who. Book.
Oh yeah, the book's hilarious. Killing the Guys Who Killed the Guy Who Killed Lincoln, a nutty story about Edwin Booth and Boston Corbett. It's not the history America needs, it's the history America deserves. And I thank you so much for joining us on SiriusXM.
John, thanks for everything. I really appreciate it. Great
what a great pleasure. Have a good one. Peace. We'll be right back with your calls in just a moment at 866-997-4748. This is Progress After Dark.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
I normally find bras to be so uncomfortable and constricting, but Skims has changed that. You know I love Skims underwear, so I finally tried their bras, and Skims has delivered again. Skims bras are worth the hype for the amazing shape and support they give, but what I wasn't expecting was how comfortable they are too. I've tried so many bras in the past, and the main issue that I have is that they weren't supportive enough, to the point where they felt slouchy. I love my Skims wireless form bra because it's so comfortable and supportive. The older I get, the more I care about actually being comfortable in what I wear every day. And with my wireless form bra, I no longer have to sacrifice my comfort for the support I need. Shop Skims bras at skims.com, now available in 62 sizes, 30A to 46H. Plus, get free shipping on all orders over $75. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know we sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select our show in the drop-down menu that follows.
How do you say I voted for Obama and then you vote for Trump? Like, what the hell is that other than you're just into popularity contests? Who's shinier? Who's popular? How do you vote to protect women's rights and vote to believe in climate science and vote to make millionaires pay their fair share and then say, you know what? I decided I don't believe in any of that anymore. Shiny things. I'm John Fugelsang. Simon Moya-Smith is an Oglala Lakota and Chicano journalist. He's a contributing writer at NBC News and TheNation.com. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Your Spirit Animal is a Jackass, and he's adjunct professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Colorado, Denver. Simon, I'm sorry we got delayed by that last troll. Welcome. It's great to have you.
Well, no worries. I was a jackass for sure.
Julie Francella is an activist, an artist, a writer, and a veteran mental health professional with over 28 years of experience working with complex trauma in the clinical field. She was executive director of a domestic violence center and spent 13 years as a clinical caseworker at a residential treatment center for Indigenous youth. She's an enrolled member of the Ojibwe Abachuana First Nation Reserve and currently works with First Nations University of Canada and is a professor at Durham College, where she teaches about the profound impacts of colonization. Julie, it's great to have you with us. Hello.
Hello, thank you, and happy third day of the Trump New York hush money trial.
I know, but we're trying to not call it the hush money trial, because that makes it sound like it was a romance that we're intruding on. We're trying to call it the Trump campaign finance fraud trial. I'm trying to use more appropriate language. Yes.
I'll update my Hallmark cards.
Thank you. You wanted to talk about this clip of this guy, Joel Webun, Julie, who's kind of set the web on fire this week with his comments about how he's a St. Paul Christian all the way and thinks women's be thinking too much. A lot of folks may have heard this already, but I just want to play this again. This is a clip from an interview that shows exactly how Christian nationalists view the way the world should be. Give a quick listen before we proceed.
Christian nationalist wand. We wake up tomorrow in a Christian nation, a Christian nationalist nation as you're describing, all right? There's a lot of fears that people have. Here's one of them. Will women have the right to vote tomorrow if you wave that magic Christian wand?
No.
Okay, why not? I want to get into why not. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Because if we had a Christian nation tomorrow and women did have the right to vote, we would not have a Christian nation within 50 years.
Okay. I honestly give them credit. At least that guy admits it. Julie, I'm fascinated why you wanted to lead off with this particular clip tonight. What about it caught your attention?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. When settlers came to our lands, they didn't just bring their beliefs and their ambitions. They tried to dismantle and decimate our societal structures where women held power and were respected leaders. You know, and when I hear talk about returning to, you know, you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, traditional values, you know, I have to question, you know, whose traditions are we really talking about? Because the ones,
yes,
you know, where Native women led and thrived are the ones that, you know, I'm used to. Are we talking about the ones that are imposed upon us that pushed, you know, women aside? And we need to remember, you know, as Indigenous people, I'm talking about, you know, sort of myself and our history, that our history didn't start with the settlers, nor did our values. And when we debate rights and rules today, I just want to encourage your listeners to not forget that the idea of women leading isn't revolutionary. It's traditional, at least
Thank
in the
you.
World that I come from and that Simon and I come from, because we don't need to restore anything. We just need to recognize and return to the equity that existed before colonization tried to erase it. And it was just so fascinating that
that's beautiful.
You know,
yeah.
He said that.
I mean, Simon, you've talked about this a lot, that within First Nations history, having a matriarchy is often the conservative point of view, that women leadership is the traditional way. And it's a great way for men to show how much true strength they actually have.
Yeah, it's logical, right? It's like the best judge of a man's character is a woman, because men are going to silverback gorilla. We're going to pound our chest. We're going to try to be tough, but we're going to be extremely, extremely vulnerable with our mothers, with our grandmothers, with our wives. And so that's why for the Lakota people, for my people, we had a women's council that chose who would be chief. They would say, okay, how about Simon? Simon would be a good candidate. And someone would say, fuck that. He's scared of bears. And so they would say, you got to go find somebody else. We can't have a chief who's scared of bears. So you would find that the Indigenous women also were the ones that, if two guys had a disagreement, for example, women were the keepers of the memory. So yeah. If two guys are like, I said this, no, you said that, the women would come in and say, no, he's right and you're wrong. And you would have to walk away. Otherwise, you would shame yourself and your family. So as Indigenous people, for the Lakota specifically, we are matrilineal. A lot of tribes are matrilineal. Nobody gives a shit about who my dad is. They care more about my mother, my grandmother, etc. So again, it just pissed off Christians. You know, they have the triangle where we have the circle. It's God, man, and everything else, right? Which includes the animals and women, etc. Whereas Indigenous people, it's a circle. We all need one another and there's no head of the table.
I love it. I mean, Julie, this can only happen in a culture where boys are raised to respect and revere the wisdom of their female elders.
Absolutely. You know, there's in Cree, the Cree language, the word for fire is iskote, and that's made up of two words. And the first part of that is woman, and the second part of that is heart. And so fire is a woman's heart. And at the center of the earth is fire. And so the whole society is based on the fact that women are the fire, women are the center. And so when, you know, settlers came, they recognized this and they wanted to exploit our mother, the earth, not, you know, revere her the way that Indigenous people did or revere women. And so they literally set out to decimate, you know, the societal, the matrilineal society that was here. And that's what they've tried to do. And, you know, we've resisted. And it's true. You know, young boys are raised in indigenous communities to respect their females and their elders, especially women in the nations. And, you know, we're sort of coming back to that. And it's really important for your listeners to understand that before settlers came here, it was a matrilineal society.
Yeah.
And that scared the Christians. Believe,
yeah. We're raised and, with and bros remember, before hoes. That's white guys are raised to believe that.
Well, remember, you know, it's true. In the language too, settler, also invader. You know, it's really important that we use that language invader, so people know that they invaded our territory. And not to fuck with people too early into the show, but Susan B. Anthony is always credited. She's always credited about starting, you know, the suffrage movement, right? And so women's rights. But she was inspired by the Haudenosaunee. She was very intimately aware of the rights and the power, the political power and position of indigenous women. She's like, wait a minute, if they can have it, I'm a white woman. I can have that. So it wasn't something that she came up with on her own. She saw it happening up in northern New York. Look it up, folks. I'm not bullshitting you.
I love that. That's totally encouraging. Let's go to the phones. Anne is on the line from California. Anne, welcome. You're on SiriusXM with Simon and Julie. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing better now. How are you?
Hi, Anne.
Yeah, I had to listen to John yell at you. That was not great.
That was nice.
Yesterday you had Stephen, and then today John.
Stephen's
I don't
lovely.
Have Sirius, so I just listened to your podcast. But I wanted to ask Julie and Simon, so I had two questions. One of them has to do with, again, with having to do with the matriarch society. I was told a story that tribal women, when they reached the age of menopause, so when they started going through menopause, they would go off, you know, together themselves, and the tribe would take care of them, but they would be off on their own until they completed the process of going through menopause. And then when they emerged, they were considered a wise woman. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, you know, many Native American societies regard menopause, as mine included, as a time of increased respect and status for women, and that acknowledges their wisdom and experience. And so in a lot of nations, that was very much true. Even in ceremony, if a woman, we're not talking menopause, but if a woman is on her cycle, we call it her moon time. And that's when they're at their most powerful. And so they're not to be coming into it and participating in ceremony, because they'll actually draw the energy away from where it should be. So women are considered extremely powerful when they're, sort of on their moon time. But menopause, as you said, is considered a time when women do sort of come into this increased wisdom, and they're revered for that. And I know it's quite beautiful, and they're treated
as opposed
such,
to here, where so, we just never talk about it, right? Where we just never talk about
right.
it. There's a couple of vague TV commercials for pills.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, and it's with a lot of different tribes and nations have their own. Yeah. I mean, the Diné have theirs. We Lakota have our own. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm going to piggyback real quick on what Julie just said. Women are very, very strong in the sense that they give life and we can't. So we're limited in women. Yeah. So, for example, when you look at a picture, if you ever go to a powwow and you'll see all the men are sitting and all the women are standing. Well, one time there was this hippy dippy lady from Boulder who went to the Denver March powwow and got pissed. Why are the men sitting and the women are standing? And an elder, an indigenous woman, had to go to her and say, this is the balance. The men have to be closer to the earth and to the drum because they can't give life. The women are so powerful. That's why they are standing. And the lady felt, you know, she felt horrible because she brought these Western white male ideals into an indigenous space where women are revered. And again, in the Bible, they refer to the land as something to be subdued, right? And we consider land our mother, Mother Earth. Yeah. You would never subdue your mom. I hope you wouldn't. But I mean, it's horrible language. Just listen to the language that influences the way they think.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's actually more pagan in thinking as well, as they think of Mother Earth as well, you know, in the pagan type of religions or religion, whatever.
Sure.
It was actually my menopause teacher who taught me that, who told me that, that women who go through menopause, that they emerge, you know, in the tribal worlds, they would emerge as a wise woman and they were revered, you know, as a wise woman. Because now
you've convinced me.
Through.
I am so ready to have the first Indigenous woman president, like now. I'm ready.
That's necessary.
Yeah.
The world would be such a better place if we had Indigenous
That would be like
leaders.
Reparations for everybody if we could have that.
Yes. And
did
then
you have
the
a second question?
Go ahead.
Yes. About Buffalo Soldiers. So I was listening to a podcast about Buffalo Soldiers, and I was trying to look it up. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were, because some of my research said that the indigenous people had named them Buffalo Soldiers. And then another report had said that, no, they didn't, because the indigenous people feel that buffaloes are, they revere the buffalo as being very strong and holy and, you know, revered in that way. And so they wouldn't think of someone who was there to conquer them. They wouldn't call them Buffalo Soldiers.
I see.
Yeah, well, okay, so when... Yeah,
do you know
ahead.
Anything about that?
Yes, I do. And Julie, don't mind if I jump in here.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they specifically came and fought us. It was a lot like the Irish. They wanted to get rid of the Irish. The United States wanted to get rid of the Irish, so they sent the Irish to fight indigenous people. And so in that case, they believed that the Indians would kill off the Irish, or the Irish would kill off the Indians. And it was the same thing with Buffalo Soldiers. And now the story goes, and again, you guys could look this up. There's a couple of stories, but originally, the idea of Buffalo Soldiers was because when they showed up, the African Americans, they had dark curly hair.
Yeah,
so they had hair that was similar to buffalo. But again, at the same time, you had one persecuted group, black people, fighting against another persecuted group, the indigenous people. And that was at the behest of old white men in places like Washington, D.C. and New York. So the Buffalo Soldiers really had nothing to do or had any animosity toward my people, toward our people.
Yeah.
But they were sent over to fight us. Because again, neither the Buffalo Soldiers or indigenous people were really even considered humans in their eyes. They just wanted to get rid of both groups.
Yeah. But there's also another theory that suggests that the name reflected respect for the soldiers' fierce way of fighting that sort of resembled the way that a buffalo was fought and was strong, so in their abilities. So that's what Simon said, that there's a few different theories, and that's one of them, two of them actually right there.
So then the name did come from the indigenous people they were sent to go and conquer or fight.
Again, for us, for the indigenous people of the plains, that was the story I heard. Is it wasn't specifically so much about how well they fought. I've heard of that one as well, but it was also because indigenous people were very descriptive. Like I said, white people are called Washichus. Washichu just means the greedy people. We weren't saying blue eyes, blonde hair, but in certain situations, we will just refer to them by a very unique characteristic, physical characteristic.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And why not?
I see. Yeah, I did read about that because their hair was similar to a buffalo's.
Yeah, the curly wool.
Curly wool. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I had no idea.
Thank you. I was curious
Thanks
about
for
that
phoning.
Because that's one of my favorite songs by Bob Marley.
Buffalo Soldier.
Right on. Well, thank
you.
Man.
And
I
know
question.
That,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and
smarter.
I know that, you know, he used the Buffalo Soldier. He's not really talking about Buffalo Soldiers. He's talking about, you know, how the black people were mistreated, and he uses the name Buffalo Soldier. But then I started doing research about why were they called Buffalo Soldiers, and where did they really come from? And it was after the Civil War. that they were sent out to the planet.
It's a great song.
Thank you
very much. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you, Anne.
That question. 866-997-4748. Guys, I have to ask you about this study that was published in The Lancet last week that's very disturbing. You know, we've heard a bit about how Americans for the past decade have been dying younger than people in other developed countries. And they've said, it's deaths of despair, that it's suicides and overdoses and alcoholism. What did the study published last week in The Lancet show that added some more color and context to these results?
Yeah. Well, I'll just quickly comment that the indigenous communities were actually initially overlooked in the research that brought the issue into public consciousness. So the term deaths of despair has been prominently associated with middle-aged white Americans. And as you said, John, it covers suicides, drug overdoses, deaths from alcoholic liver disease. And the study that was published last week in The Lancet, it rectifies this oversight by showing that actually American Indian and Alaska Native populations actually experience the highest rates of these tragic deaths. And so the implications, you know, they're profound, and they highlight not only a public health crisis, but also, as we've talked about often on this program, the systemic failures in healthcare accessibility and, you know, community support and research inclusivity. And so, you know, that basically was the newest finding, was that American Indians and Alaska Native populations actually experienced the highest rates of these tragic deaths.
Yep. And it seems to me, Simon, that this is something that's really quite preventable if we had the will to prevent it.
No, absolutely. I mean, Indian Health Services sucks. I know some people that don't know what Indian Health Services is. Really briefly, it's the United States providing a limited form of healthcare to indigenous communities. That means, and I've said this before, that there usually aren't specialists. So it's a clinic. So if you go in there and you have GI distress and you need to see a GI doc, they're not typically going to have one. And they're grossly underfunded. And this even goes into things like psychology, psychiatrists, because we live with intergenerational trauma. And if you're not familiar with it, I want you to look that up. Intergenerational trauma comes from a time when, again, we were dehumanized. From the massacres, the murders, to the prison camps we call now reservations. And we didn't have something. I mean, some tribes had beer, right? Corn beer down here in the Pueblo area. They did that. It was a low alcohol content, high carbs, good for the runners. But things like whiskey, et cetera, that, you know, those are fairly new to our systems. And so indigenous people do, you know, struggle with alcoholism and abuse, but it's also not very different from other humans. We all cope with trauma in our own way. Everybody does one thing or another. It could be food, could be sex, could be anything, the way that you just are trying to dull the voices and dull the pain. And so we also have to understand that indigenous people, while we have the stereotype of being alcoholics, indigenous people are still struggling with that intergenerational trauma that our fathers and our mothers and our grandparents unfortunately passed on to us.
I mean, the study looked at death rates for 45 to 54-year-olds from 1999 to 2013. And in that 14-year period, deaths among Native Americans went up by 30% in that age bracket.
Yeah.
And deaths 30%. Among white Americans went up by about 9%. Somehow I think if like the population of blonde white teenagers went up 30% in deaths, that we'd hear a lot more about this. Julie, I'm sorry I cut you off.
No. I mean, also, I think it's important to recognize that Indigenous people live in a society that was built upon the hope that they would not exist anymore. And I think that a lot of Indigenous people still live in, you know, communities where they're ostracized. They are looked at as being, you know, pariahs. They're looked at as being, you know, all of the stereotypes that you want to throw at them. And many people don't understand the history. You know, 42% of Canadians don't know that there were residential schools. They just think Native people obviously are lazy and they're drunks and they're all of these horrible stereotypes, without understanding the trauma, the historical trauma that, you know, Indigenous people have experienced and have basically survived. And I think that's the important thing. So programs like this allow for us to kind of talk about these things and let, you know, people know that there's a history here that's by design has been, you know, sort of hidden. It's not in the history books, you know, and like we talk about 1923 and people are like, did that really happen? Yeah. I see people Googling, is that really true? The scene with the nun and the indigenous girl, and people are shocked to find out that it actually is part of the history in the United States and in Canada. And that's what people are still dealing with, that, like as Simon said, intergenerational trauma. And so we have to come up with culturally tailored health programs and legislative advocacy that will help us, you know, combat these issues.
And stop excluding us from these studies, right? Julie said
we weren't even included.
Right. Yeah, they had to rectify it. They go, oh, shit, Native Americans, forgot about them. They usually
do. Yeah, they're still here. Oh, wait, let's redo this.
That fucking guys,
We have to take a very quick break. Please stay with us because I want to do another Did You Know with you guys and maybe take some more calls if we have a chance. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Our number is 866-997-4748. We'll be right back in just a moment with Simon and Julie. This is Progress. Welcome back. We are joined by Simon Moya-Smith and Julie Francella. Let's do another round of Did You Know? We haven't done that in a couple of weeks. Simon, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, so this one is a little trippy, and it comes from Ray, my partner. So in the 1930s, this was really shitty. The United States government went to a little, essentially an island of the Yupiks, and dropped a bunch of muskox there and didn't tell them. So imagine that you're there in your village, and you're just like, okay, what the hell is that coming toward us? What the fuck is that eating my dog? And this was in the 1930s, and they called it an agricultural experiment. But imagine you're at home and you just see some random fucking beast coming your way. They did that to the Yupik.
Wow. What were the long-term environmental effects of doing this? We hear about a fish to a new pond and it wreaks havoc with an ecosystem. What happened here?
Well, they came from Greenland, so after a while they were tame, but when they got there, they just freaked out, and so they would attack the indigenous people, they would attack the tents. So far now, they're there, and they kind of live the same thing with, like, reindeer. They were recently introduced in the past 100 years, so now it's part of life, but at that time, it just looks like you seriously didn't tell any of the indigenous people you're putting this long-haired, bighorn fucking beast onto their land, and you're just not going to tell them.
Julie, did you know that? I didn't know that.
I actually did not know that. I did not know that.
Wow.
Thanks, Ray and Simon.
Thank you, Ray. It was a pleasure having her on our show, by the way, Simon. Wow. We're big fans of your partner. Julie, what have you got tonight for us?
Well, did you know that for many Indigenous people, continuous eye contact may not be expected or appreciated? Many non-Indigenous people, as you know, believe that it's important to maintain eye contact during conversations. But for residential school survivors, eye contact with school or church officials could have resulted in physical punishment. So therefore, many Indigenous people look at eye contact as being not something that is expected or appreciated or used to. And this is mostly for our elders who have... you know, a lot of them have gone to residential schools, and that was just something that they avoid eye contact. So
I had no idea.
Did you know?
Wow. Yeah. Simon, I don't know what to make of that. That's just painful.
It's different, right? It's the same thing with, like, a while back when I was working with the Rocky Mountain News and I was reporting on a Chabad house. I didn't know that Jewish men, like the men, are supposed to shake hands. And so I did the faux pas. I went to shake her hand to thank her to allow me to report, and she jumped back. So, you know, you live and learn.
You monster, you. Oh. Yeah, I know how it is. I usually manage to offend or be awkward in every kind of cultural setting. Julie, you were just at the UN today for the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues? Or was that yesterday?
I was.
Yes.
That was today. That was this morning. Yeah. No, I have a friend of mine who she is the vice chief for the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations. Her name is Ali Bear, and I presented her with a portrait that I painted of her. And the United Nations has a permanent forum on Indigenous issues, and this year's theme was enhancing Indigenous people's rights to self-determination, and it emphasized Indigenous youth voices. And the event, I think it's on its 10th year now, and it aims to address pressing issues related to economic and social development, culture, the environment, especially climate change, education, health, and overall human rights of Indigenous communities. And so people attending this forum, you know, the participants have opportunity to share their experiences and their challenges and to engage with, especially with policymakers, to influence international policy directly. And so my friend Ali, she's a lawyer. And in Canada, just a little side note here, that the Indian Act in Canada prohibited Native people from hiring lawyers or becoming lawyers until 1951. The government did not want us to know our own rights or fight for our rights. Isn't that crazy?
Damn.
Yeah.
Simon, do you want to follow up? Do you have another did you know for our final
Sure. It's a really quick one. So the Washoe people by Lake Tahoe, just so everybody knows, white people just didn't understand. They were saying da'au. Da'au means lake. So they were like, oh, I guess this is Lake Tahoe. No, you're saying lake, lake.
Oh,
that's like three cheese queso. When people are like, yeah, let's get some three cheese queso. And you're like, that's cheese. Or Navajo Native American. The like hell? There's Navajo anywhere else in the world but here.
I love it. Love it. How do we follow you, Simon?
On Instagram at Simon Said Take a Pic, and then on Twitter or X at Simon Moya Smith.
Julie Francella, how do our listeners follow you?
Julie Francella on all social media platforms.
Guys, I spend all week looking forward to this. Thank you so much for elevating our show. We gotta go. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Thea. I'm John Fiegel saying keep it tuned to SiriusXM Progress. Peace.